Welcome to It's All Politics from NPR News. I'm Ron Elving.
And I'm Ken Reardon. And Ron Elving, it seems like that bad, somber, sullen mood that we had last week about Boston and what's going on in the country has not gone away.
It has not lifted. It persists. And there are a lot of reasons for that. Among other things, it was a rather large cloud in the first place. It went on all week. We had the dramatic arrest of the second suspect on Friday night. That story continues as his interrogation continues. We also, of course, had the tragedy in Texas with the blowing up of a fertilizer plant in West Texas, where even as we speak, we're recording this on Thursday, the president is going there for a memorial service.
After he stops off at a fundraiser.
After he stops off at a fundraiser, and also as part of a trip where he's also going to honor George W. Bush at the dedication of his presidential library in Dallas.
And, of course, if the president cannot make the Bush dedication personally, they can just play back some of his comments during the 2008 and 2012 campaign.
Yes, I'm sure that those are available right there at the President Bush Presidential Library.
Yes. The theme, what I got this week, is that unlike 9/11, which was a tragedy, and Boston, of course, was a tragedy, but this has become political. The news of the last couple of months, the tragedy in Boston, the tragedy in Newtown, Sandy Hook. So it's guns and it's immigration, and yet again, we're back to pointing fingers.
You know, it's interesting. We're seeing the five living presidents, current and former, gathered together for this presidential library picture, which is kind of a tradition, getting all the living presidents together, if possible, for such a photograph. And that is a bipartisan moment, quite naturally. We've got two Republicans and three Democrats. Of course, both Republicans are named George Bush. This is a moment for people to feel a little bit more American and a little bit more, if you will, bipartisan about our political figures. And even so, back here in Washington, there really doesn't seem to be any of the old camaraderie, any of the old spirit by which, for example, after 9/11, you had a fairly contentious House of Representatives all turn out on the steps to sing God Bless America a couple of days after that attack. It's hard to imagine this group doing that.
Well, they're not doing it. And if you think of in the aftermath of Boston, when you had the Gang of Eight deciding to sing that perhaps we will have this successful overhaul of the immigration system, and then you have Chuck Grassley, the ranking Republican on Judiciary Committee, saying, well, maybe we should hold up. Maybe we should alter some of the language because of the allowing the Chechen brothers into the country. One, I guess, became a naturalized citizen, but changing the whole laws about that. At the same time, the same Republicans are saying we shouldn't rush to judgment on guns, as tragic as Newtown was, because you shouldn't write laws based on tragedy, based on horrific events. So it's just kind of weird watching the political dynamic on it.
Can't ask for too much consistency when No. you're responding on a political basis to these things. But clearly, those Republicans who do not favor quick action on immigration, or certainly not quick action on immigration that totally overhauls the law in such a way as to make it easier for some people in the country now illegally to become legal, even over a long period of time, those people, the opponents, have felt at a disadvantage, not only because of the results of the last election and not only because the Democrats are all pushing this bill, or most all of them, but because so many in their own party are saying, come on, you've got to get on the bandwagon. We've got to do better among Hispanic voters down the road. So we're going to have to do this. And a lot of them are digging in their heels. And this has been the first opportunity they've had, these events in Boston, to get a little bit of traction for their point of view and say, let's not go so fast.
Yeah, and I was just thinking the other day about the groups that have formed in the wake of Sandy Hook and Gabby Giffords and Mark Kelly. You know, they had this new group trying to pressure lawmakers into passing gun legislation. And they have a new ad attacking Mitch McConnell and Kelly Ayotte, two Republicans, for their votes against the background checks. I also know that Mark Begich and Mark Pryor and Max Baucus and Heidi Heitkamp are Democrats who also voted against it, but they're not going to their states for it. So to play politics about Boston, to play politics about gun violence, is just not the way this country should be going.
Well, maybe not, but if you're the Republican Party and you've just been handed another defeat in the last November elections, at least at the presidential and senatorial levels, and you're looking for ways to undercut what otherwise seems like a democratic era in a lot of people's minds and change the political momentum, change the political direction of the country, you're going to seize on every opportunity. And when you look at something like what just happened in Boston, you look at that and you say, well, can we show that the government maybe should have done a better job of preventing this? Was there intelligence about these two brothers that we should have used to maybe take them into custody or maybe in some sense or another keep them from doing what they've allegedly done? And at the very least, was there intelligence that should have been more broadly shared within the government? Here's some of the Republicans who have been talking about this past week.
I have concerns about what agencies knew what and the fact that it wasn't shared. But I think our committees in the coming days and weeks are going to get to the bottom of this, so we'll have real facts at our disposal.
Post 9/11, we thought we had created a system that would allow for the free flow of information between agencies, and I think there's been some stone walls and some stovepipes reconstructed that were probably unintentional.
I would still say the main question is the FBI's investigation going back to 2011. And why it was not followed up since then.
Now, of course, those were three Republicans. That was the Speaker of the House, John Boehner. That was Georgia Senator Saxby Chambliss. And it was New York Congressman Peter King. And you notice that none of them blamed President Obama. They didn't mention President Obama. And actually, I think they did ask legitimate questions. We've known for several days that the Russian government did go to the FBI and said they have concerns about one of the brothers and he's coming back to Russia or Chechnya. They wanted to alert U.S. government intelligence agencies about possible connections they may have with terrorists. And now
was it their concern for the United States, though, or was it their concern that he was coming back to Russia and being some sort of a Chechen separatist?
Oh, absolutely. And I mean, that's a fair reason for the Russians to contact the U.S. And then we also learned that the FBI apparently questioned the older brother and got nothing out of it and said, well, we don't have any proof that he's any ties with extremist groups.
And this was a couple of years ago, not in recent months.
Right, 2011, right.
Would not necessarily have been an opportunity for the FBI to search his apartment and find pressure cookers and guns.
And then we also learned the Russians went to the CIA and expressed the same kind of concerns. So I think what we heard the Republicans asking, to me, these don't seem to be outrageous questions, just what did the government know, when did they know it, and what could they have done about it? And of course, those are fair questions.
You know, another element in the turmoil of the last couple of weeks have been these letters that were sent to President Obama and to Senator Roger Wicker of Mississippi and also to a local judge in Mississippi.
Carl Levin's office in Saginaw.
And these letters were supposedly contaminated with what appears to have been the deadly chemical ricin. And this poison was not the sort of thing that you can just go down to the store and buy. So it's the kind of thing that, generally speaking, leaves some sort of residue and some sort of trace, some sort of fingerprint. The man who was originally arrested and charged in connection with those letters, Paul Kevin Curtis of Mississippi, they couldn't find any such evidence anywhere around him or anywhere around his life. And in questioning him, they found no reason to think that he could have been responsible for these letters. It looked more as though somebody else had set him up to make him look as though he were responsible for these letters. And now the government is looking at yet another person who has been involved in entertainment.
I think they're both Elvis impersonators.
I think they also had a podcast together at some point.
That's impersonating. Maybe they were impersonating us. That's kind of scary.
But anyway, that's a big industry in Mississippi.
But it seems like Paul Kevin Curtis is enjoying this bit of 15-minute fame.
Do you think his fees might be actually a little higher when he goes out to impersonate Elvis?
Well, I kind of think there may be some indication of some mental instability that his family members have discussed. But Curtis,
maybe his fees can be still higher.
It's worked for us, but I think that's clearly Curtis is enjoying every minute of it.
When you've been charged with something, you've never heard of ricin or whatever. I thought they said rice, so I said I don't even eat rice.
I tell you, comedy like that.
It's clear that he's a killer of one kind.
Laugh riot. And speaking of laugh riots, we got the news that Max Baucus is announced this week that he's retiring, despite the fact that he has $5 million in the bank, despite the fact that he has no credible Republican opponent. Now, I saw a lot of websites that said, well, you know, he's fearful because Mitt Romney carried Montana by like 14 points, and it's a Republican-leaning state, which is exactly what we said about John Tester.
Now, Richard Nixon carried Montana as well at a time when it had two Democratic senators who were pretty liberal and getting elected without too much trouble. It's hard for me to see how Max Baucus was really under that much of a threat, and yet you will find a lot of people saying he's retreating now because he's afraid he might not win a seventh term.
Well, I don't think that was the case at all. I mean, I don't know what it was. I know that there are a lot of Democrats who did not like him. He was one of the four Democrats who voted against the background checks on the guns the other day, and a lot of Democrats were angry at him for that. Could he have won again? Probably, but the Democrats are now talking about former Governor Brian Schweitzer, who actually ran against Conrad Burns for the Senate a bunch of years ago. He left the governorship, Schweitzer did, in January. Very, very popular.
Very popular.
Yep.
And populist
and
as well.
Yes.
And really more of a forthright liberal on a lot of issues than Max Baucus ever was.
Right.
Although I don't think that he would automatically be a gun vote that the president could count on.
Oh,
he's
no,
much more like a Montanan when it comes to guns.
Oh, he's a beaut. No, really. But he is pro-gun. He is prophylactic. But he's anti-pasta.
You know, this podcast is going to hell in a handbasket.
Yes. Oh, very nice. But the Democrats are hopeful Schweitzer will run. The guess is that he does run. And so unlike some other Democratic retirements in West Virginia with Jay Rockefeller and perhaps Tim Johnson in South Dakota, I think the Democrats hold on to Montana, especially if Schweitzer runs. And that's the guess.
And Schweitzer will be an entertaining element, I think, in the Senate. It's been a while since we've had anybody quite as outspoken with their kind of prairie populism as Brian Schweitzer has been, and he has been an entertaining figure at past political conventions.
Yes, sir.
I would think that the Democrats would be happy to have somebody with his particular, if you will, media chops in that particular seat. Not to, you know, assume that he's already elected, and he has been kind of a controversial figure in his own way. We'll just have to see if he decides to run.
And, you know, we were talking earlier about Boston, and, of course, there's another Senate seat open in Massachusetts. And you talk about what Boston needs right now is just some kind of a calming of the nerves. But Ed Markey and Stephen Lynch, the two Democratic congressmen who had their final debate this week, of course, their primary is this coming Tuesday, it was just nasty and personal and insulting and charges hurled back and forth. And not that we should ever be surprised that politicians do these things to each other, but somehow you think maybe in Boston and Massachusetts, given what's happened there, maybe you just go a little light, but that's not what's happening.
But you know, it's funny, the less that politicians maybe disagree on most of the issues, at least on the ones they want to talk about, the more they have to make a contrast between each other in terms of personality or in terms of, you know, who is the person with more integrity than the other. And it gets a little bit raucous just because they don't really have all that many issues that they can disagree about.
Well, the issue that they jumped on this time was, of course, port security. And, of course, that plays into what happened in Boston. And Stephen Lynch said that because Ed Markey voted against this commission that basically was responsible for tracking down the two brothers, he's soft on security. And Ed Markey says, wait a second, the reason I voted against it is because the U.S. military would have been involved, and that's not what I believe in. So I mean, there are reasons for both sides, but of course it was just nasty. And do I think the Republicans, whoever they are, will benefit? I don't.
Well, they don't have a Scott Brown.
No.
A Scott Brown decided not to run for this particular opening after his defeat in November by Elizabeth Warren. He decided he would maybe look for his opportunities in the private sector and perhaps in another state in politics later on, Massachusetts being kind of a tough customer for a Republican. And it doesn't really appear as though the Republicans were able to look to their ranks and find somebody else. They don't have, for example, members of Congress that they could nominate.
They have none. They have,
they not, have not a single member of the House.
Well, they're all married.
After a suitable pause, we'll go
on. That pause was excellent, actually. That long pause was perfect. That deserves a pause.
Well, but in the past, though, you've had the William Welds, you've had the Mitt Romneys, you've had people who could step up and from a position of more or less establishmentarianism, Republicanism, step in and run statewide and win.
Yes, for governor perhaps, but even Mitt Romney, who was the strongest candidate Ted Kennedy ever faced, Mitt Romney did get clobbered by Ted Kennedy in that great Republican year of 1994. So for the most part, I think Massachusetts Senate politics, at least, is going back to normalcy, which means that the winner of the Democratic primary will be the next senator.
And that's what we assume will also happen in the state of Hawaii, traveling as far to the west as you can and still be in the United States. But there's going to be a nasty fight, it appears, for the Democratic nomination between the current senator, Brian Schatz, who was appointed by Governor Neil Abercrombie last winter upon the death of Daniel Inouye.
Schatz was Abercrombie's lieutenant governor.
That's right. He moved over from being lieutenant governor to this seat. He would like to stay. He'd like to get reelected or to get elected for the first time as the senator from Hawaii. But he's going to have to get past, it appears, Colleen Hanabusa.
Yes, and Colleen Hanabusa, of course, is one of the two members of the House from Hawaii. She was apparently Daniel Inouye's choice to succeed him. I think his dying wish was that he wanted Colleen Hanabusa to succeed him. Governor Abercrombie went his own way and picked Schatz. And so this seems to be mostly about pique and ambition. It's not that Schatz isn't liberal. It's not that Schatz is not a loyal Democrat.
I don't see any issues
here. No. This seems to be personal ambition and looks like she may be very close to challenging him in the Democratic primary.
Now, interestingly, this is going to be cast as a little bit of an echo of 2008 because Abercrombie and Schatz were both with Obama in 2008, and Colleen Hanabusa was the spokesperson for Hillary Clinton in Hawaii. And so those divisions within the Democratic Party, which will never entirely go away, no matter what the Obamas and the Clintons themselves personally may have worked out, those animosities within some of the state parties still live on.
Just like Massachusetts, there is no measurable Republican strength in Hawaii.
What about Linda Lingle?
Linda Lingle,
she run again?
She could, and she got clobbered in 2012 when she tried to run for the Senate. Matter of fact, she lost to the same person she clobbered when they ran against each other for governor years ago. I think Linda Lingle's star has come and gone, and again, as you say, Massachusetts and now Hawaii, the issue will be decided in the Democratic primary.
Okay, and this is an issue in another state we thought would be resolved in the Republican primary, but Mark Sanford, who won that Republican primary in the 1st District of South Carolina and that special election there, is not necessarily going to be the next representative from South Carolina. I ask you, why not, Ken Reardon?
Well, you know, something that has nothing to do with Elizabeth Colbert Bush.
I don't think it does either.
Who's a Democratic nominee. This is all about Mark Sanford. It's all been about Mark Sanford from the beginning. If the election were held today, I think that she would actually win it.
But there's a debate coming.
There's a debate
week.
Coming up, right. And there has been some ads where he's gone after her as being a typical pro-union liberal. But that's not what the issue is. And you know what? The issue isn't even jobs. He says that, you know, she's responsible for hurting jobs because of a union policies. The issue is Mark Sanford. It's how he treated his ex-wife, Jenny Sanford. It's what he's been doing. And it's all about his behavior. I mean, it's like Anthony Weiner in New York. He could have 7,000 ideas how he'd be the greatest mayor of New York. But the point is, you look at Anthony and you think Weiner. If you look at Mark, you think Sanford.
Absolutely. And if he can't control his Sanford, how can he be a respectable member of Congress?
Exactly what I was thinking about New York.
So my question here is, is there any way that the Republican Party is happy to lose this seat rather than have Mark Sanford win and come back to Washington and be in some sense or another, even just marginally, a symbol of the Republican Party with all of his baggage and all of his problems?
Well, that's a fair question. As we speculated in last week's podcast, the perfect scenario for the Republicans would be Elizabeth Colbert Bush wins this year, and then Jenny Sanford comes back in 2014, wins the seat. Look, just as objectionable as Todd Akin, some of his comments were in Missouri, would the Republicans rather have had Todd Akin than Claire McCaskill?
Sure.
I think yes.
Yeah. Absolutely. They want the vote.
Right.
That's a vote in the Senate for 6 years. Here you're talking about a kind of a meaningless vote. It doesn't make any difference to the majority in the House. And in, you know, just 18 months, they could have someone they would much prefer to have who might be a statewide figure for them in South Carolina. But if they get Mark Sanford back, it's going to be difficult for him to be removed.
I've thought that too, but you know, then it reminds me of David Vitter in Louisiana, who was the object of such scorn and humiliation when, of course, his involvement in the prostitution scandal. I'm not comparing the two things.
He never really had the national profile, though, that Mark Sanford does.
Right. Really didn't. Sanford was talking about running for president.
And also, his fall was so spectacular. Yeah. And by the way, some of his campaign literature, I don't know if you've seen it, but it bears a remarkable resemblance to the flag of Argentina.
He is so pompous.
Hey, and by the way, while President Obama is there on the campus of Southern Methodist University there in Dallas at the new Bush Presidential Library, I wonder if he'll take advantage of that particular feature they have in the library where you go in this room.
Interactive, right?
An interactive, exactly, where you go in this room, you sit there, and they pose big decisions from the Bush years, and they give you a couple of advisors on tape to give you both sides of the argument or the multi-sides of the argument, and then you decide whether to invade Iraq, and you decide whether to send in the National Guard in New Orleans after Katrina, and you make other big decisions from those years, and then on comes George W. Bush to say, no, that's wrong. Here's what I did, and well, this is why I was right.
But, Ron, you know, every time you think about the Bush Library, you think about the Bush legacy and the Bush future. And, of course, Jeb Bush is, you know, on the circuit for 2016, we think.
Showing a little ankle. Maybe two.
His brother, George W. Bush, and Laura Bush apparently say, yes, run.
Absolutely. George says, my brother Jeb would make a great president.
But that's not the advice that Jeb got from his mom.
I think it's a great country. There are a lot of great families. And it's not just four families or whatever. There are other people out there that are very qualified, and we've had enough Bushes.
Hey, thanks, Mom. And that's it for this week's political podcast.
You can follow NPR's political coverage at npr.org/politics.
I'm Ron Elving.
And I'm Ken Rudin. The podcast is produced by Bracton Booker and edited by Kathy Shaw.
Join us again next week for It's All Politics from NPR.